The Mad Adventurers Society presents...
Soaring from Kuan to Agamar, we go back to the starting adventures suggested in party creation.
Sit around the holodeck and listen to some tales from the Hydean Way. We're your hosts, Cameron Kalka
and Ben Yendel. Today we're starting off looking at adventure seeds that Fantasy Flight has already given us, namely the party equipment, such as the ships from Edge of the Empire, the materiel from Age of Rebellion, or the three very different things from Force and Destiny, as well as the wonderful homestead or business from Far Horizons. Starting off, you've got, just going with Edge of the Empire Core, you've got three different ships. How one would end up acquiring them is very different. The Wayfarer is a giant ship. The YT-1300 is the stock Star Wars ship, and you've got the Firespray, which is the wonderful Boba Fett ship. So, each of them have a very different feel to it, and if you wanted to, you could have the first adventure for the party going out and acquiring one of these three. Kind of like what they do in the beginner box, with the beginner box having you end up with a YT-1300. Now, doing this as a first adventure, is there anything that kind of jumps to your mind for any of these ships or the homesteads?
Well, jumping into the ships from Edge of the Empire, I mean, each of the three ships has, as you mentioned, a very distinct feel to them that leads to a different set of stories depending on what the crew is attempting to do and who they're acquiring it from. Let's say your first adventure, for example, is them stealing a ship. If you're stealing a Firespray system patrol craft, that's more of a bounty hunter type ship. You know, the enemies that you are making are going to be, you know, some militant or bounty hunter or security type people, while a YT-1300 is one of the more common smuggler ships. So just the plots that you can create from even just the two different ship types at the start can be different. A Wayfarer is a large cargo ship, so maybe you're stealing that directly from some Hutt cartel or...
Well, with a Wayfarer, you could even be working for a Hutt cartel, or even just a stand-up business person, as the operational crew of the Wayfarer, and you're working to pay off the ship, which is one of the wonderful common obligations, that you've been able to put up half the ship cost, and they're slowly paying out the rest to the actual owner of the ship, and you're running essentially a franchise. Or, if you're wanting to be stealing it, the Wayfarer is a fairly large ship, so unless you've got a really large player group, taking a look at the crew complement, it's almost too much.
I wouldn't say it's too much. You have about 9 different crew people, and depending on, you know, what types they are and what your party's comprised of, I think it could be a exciting adventure to start off as, especially if your crew is something in the realm of pirates or something of that nature.
Oh, I think it would be a very interesting ship to do. I'm just taking a look at from a basic, how much the complement's saying it takes to run. It's one of the few ships that the GM could realistically toss in some NPCs with as just general crew operating on it, if they were wanting to.
And that's where some of the other obligations may come in as well. You know, you could do family or, because it is, you know, part of the family's business, and you are, you know, the next heir in line of some transport company.
Considering there's actually 10 crew for it, you could go full out Firefly on it, considering the wide variety of people there.
That's true. And with a ship that size, I would be very tempted to take some of the homestead rules for acquiring NPCs and apply them to the transport as well, so that over time you could acquire certain crew members through obligation to add to your ship.
That would be a very good way of doing it. Running it completely as a business, but since everyone's living there and working out of it, it's sort of a combination of homestead and business, and as a GM to sort of picking and choosing which parts from there you're wanting to have. Whether you're wanting to have a license to be able to run something that's less than legal in a few systems.
Right, because, I mean, the best business model for an illegal smuggling or, you know, weapons dealing, etc., is the one that can get away from trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Or even just the ability to use trading and going to new places as a plot hook for exploring new worlds.
Well, it allows for you to change the scenery depending on how your players are wanting to deal with things. And it really can open up a ongoing campaign, making it a lot more of a free-ranging thing. It's a fairly cool idea, that. One thing that could be a bit interesting is making sure that the players have a place to keep coming back to with the ship, so that it isn't just going from place to place to place to place. Such as having an independent shipper that is trying to constantly use them, since they become very good at being on time. It becomes, they get a bit of a reputation, and then they're starting to be used a lot more.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of ideas like that which you can use, which will be able to split the, I would almost say, standard Edge of the Empire campaign away from the Firefly-esque smuggling group and try out new things on the Edge. I mean, not everyone's a smuggler.
Exactly. You had mentioned the Firespray as a bounty hunter ship where it could be stolen, or the party is a group that is either the retinue of a bounty hunter or they're all bounty hunters in one way or another, and are using the Firespray to go off and collect up bounties. Though it's still a fairly good, or a relatively good ship in a fight, so it could also be the ship initially given to a small commando squad of mercenaries.
Yeah, as a combat-oriented ship, I would expect it to be used by a group that has more military or bounty-hunting tendencies, where they're going to be using it to attack other ships or trying to use the ship's aggressive firepower to do stuff.
Well, it definitely is a good ship for that. Well, it's a pretty good ship for doing that style and using the ship as a combat vessel as opposed to just having it to be getting from point A to point B without having to do many mods to it. The YT-1300 or even the Wayfarer can become quite the combat ship if you put enough money into it, but the Firespray starts off with a little bit better military equipment, so it's a bit more lending itself to a more aggressive style of play. The more I've been toying around with the idea in my head, I kind of like the idea of this is how the players are getting the ship. That something is going on, they need a ship, and they are acquiring it one way or another. Whether they're being given the ship because they're the only crew around to man it for a shipping concern, or whether there's a bounty that just got away and they're being sent after it for the fire spray. And it creates sort of a inciting incident for the next adventure.
I would agree. I would say that because these are large assets and the point of these assets is to span most, if not the entire length of the campaign, that it is a good thing to center on in a starting session, an episode zero per se, because, you know, it is a good way to have everyone in the party then be able to contribute in some way to the acquisition instead of it being a single player's ship.
Well, that way everyone's got a bit of attachment to it. It's not, as you're saying, just one person's, oh, that's the captain. It's the entire party's ship, and they've all done something to acquire it. Even if it's one person's just the pilot for it, they're then still pivotal in something for acquiring it, whether it's flying out of a rapidly closing hangar bay or something along that lines. It's creating a connection to the ship, and the ship then becomes almost a game master NPC.
And in a lot of ways, it's going to be a Game Master NPC, because the GM a lot of times is going to be using these assets to either introduce new plot hooks or dwindling some of the party resources over time.
And that's a really good way of doing it, whether it's having the ship take damage and becoming very expensive to repair. I mean, critical hits, the amount of money that you're pouring into it can be phenomenal. Even just the per point hull repair can be causing some people to take on new obligations. So it can really lead to parties being a lot more attached to the ship, and it then becoming, an extra member to the party, as opposed to just a tool to get from point A to point B.
Right.
It isn't just a flying set of plot hooks and exposition. It's something that the players care about. And it's something that can grow with the party, which is also a pretty nice thing. Now, I know Far Horizons gave a few ideas on how players could go about acquiring a homestead. Even for sort of a session zero, the players sort of sitting around the proverbial cantina table and having a legal droid find one of the characters, plopping a envelope down on their lap, and then beetling off. They open it up, and their long-lost uncle has left them a mine or some other business or a ranch that they then, it's now in their name, and they have a little bit of time that they have to go and get it and take possession.
Sure, but once again, that leads to the same problem of one PC controlling an asset. I mean, you could take that same idea and turn it on its side where none of the PCs necessarily know each other, and each of them has a legal droid plop a document on their lap saying that this one person who they do all know has left them, unbeknownst to them, a share of this property. And they only meet each other for the first time when they all arrive there and realize that it's not theirs. It is a group of people who now own this.
Yeah, and that then becomes a very good fish out of water style thing of, okay, I own a quarter of this. No one has enough money to buy out anyone else. How do we deal with this? And then, of course, you have some trouble beset them.
Correct. And, you know, no one then will want to lose it because they all have a share in this. But on the other hand, some characters will be looking for a way to get these shares out of other characters' hands, which can lead to interesting inter-party dynamics as well.
And that's definitely the case. Or, depending on what troubles that the GM throws at them, it could be bringing the entire party together sort of as a us-against-the-world kind of thing. And it sort of shows why that they would then have a common skill that they would all learn in trying to keep the business or the homestead running.
For an exploration campaign, I know one of the first things that I would be doing in a session zero is having the players figure out where they're going to build this homestead. It's, you know, you're landing or you're looking at maps of a world that you're surveying or something to that degree. And, you know, they as a group are deciding where they're going to put the base of operations on a map the GM has created.
Yeah, have a very rough map that you lay out in front of the players and say, okay, this is the planet that you're looking at. Where are you going to be setting up your homestead?
And that can work extremely well in a sandbox type campaign, because where they put their homestead could lead to a lot of different adventure hooks, because they don't realize that, you know, they just built this homestead on some native group's ancient lands, or, you know, right in the middle of two different warring tribes.
Or accidentally on the testing ground for an Imperial weapons facility.
And, you know, it's even simple things like that. When you're giving the players a lot of choice and a lot of input into it, it's going to make them want to defend it more because it feels like it's theirs instead of just a shiny toy that the GM has given them.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes it a lot more interesting to the players. If you're running a sandbox like what you're describing, having a fairly generalized map then, with a lot of blank spaces, then allows the GM to start putting other things into it. As things come up, like, say, two sessions in, you have a plot device that, yes, they do have two warring factions on them. Since you've got a fair amount of space on it, they can both be sort of penciled in. It's a fairly nice aspect of it, having a general map and then having the players be able to mess around with it.
Yeah, that would be one of the takeaways I would have from doing a sandbox campaign in the past, is that the more general the map with a few points of interest is way better than a detailed map with a lot of history behind it. Because then, as the players are showing interest in certain things, you or they can pencil in where rumors and other things are happening without them already knowing, oh yeah, 2 miles to the north is the old base that was abandoned 100 years ago type of thing.
Oh, exactly. No, there could be the old base that was abandoned a few kilometers to the north, but until you actually bring this up, they could have just been driving by it all this time and not really realized what it was. Yeah, no, that's a really fun aspect of doing a sandbox campaign with having a base of operations for the players to come back to. It really allows them to take ownership of the facility that they're working out of, whether it is a business or a homestead. And with them having a fixed location around a pocket of civilization, it allows the GM to start introducing recurring characters and have them grow as the PCs are interacting with them. So the barkeep that one of the players just keeps on trying to swindle finally cottons on.
Early on, it's probably a really good idea to introduce them to a lot of the various NPCs that you have, even if in passing, because the players will tend to gravitate towards certain ones because they seem more interesting. Versus just giving them an NPC and you thinking that they're going to be interested or wanting to do more with them, sometimes the players will just have absolutely no interest in doing anything more with this person, and thus it feels bland overall because there's no one interesting that they're interacting with.
Mm-hmm. Having a town where they're able to run into several different people. They'd run into a bunch of shopkeepers, they'd run into several suppliers. It would be, and since they're running into several of the same general sort, you can come up with different styles of play for them and see which ones they interact with more. So you can use that as a gauge to become deeper ingrained with the town or deeper ingrained with just the area in general around them and making it more interesting to be with.
Sure, but one of the things I would say not to do, or to make sure not to do, is do not parade NPCs out in front of the group. One of the best things is if you can get your characters to start looking for various NPCs for some reason. In one of the games I had, one of my characters, no matter what town he was in, basically tried to make contact with the local thieves guild, basically.
Okay.
It was his thing, was go to a new town, figure out where the underworld is, how they're established, and, you know, what favors can he trade to get the party advantage later on. That became one of the things that I knew that he would do wherever they went, so I would try to then come up with interesting characters for him to meet.
Yeah, now that's a very good way of doing it. If a player starts having a particular shtick when they go into town, you can start preparing for that and making that more and more interesting for them, as opposed to just being almost dismissive with it. Not using it as a parade of people, even if they are in just a local town, you can have them interact with different sectors or different suppliers. Even if they're just running, say, a mining operation, there's still 3 or 4 different suppliers that they're going to need, whether it's parts, explosives, or whatever. They're going to be needing a few different suppliers, and they can see how the suppliers are interacting. And you can even have little NPC rivalries show up and make it a more interesting place to be.
Yeah, that's one of the best things, is if your table can come alive to that point where plots and such sort of either normally develop, or your players learn about these rivalries and find ways to play the NPCs off each other. You know, they're trying to go for a particular deal on something they really need. And as the guy's, you know, putting up a tough negotiation, they kind of mention, well, you know, this other guy was mentioning that he might have one in stock too, so maybe we'll just go over there.
Exactly. And then if it's a player's coming up with something, you can do a little bit of scrambling to play that out. But if you've got a couple already done NPCs, you can start off with having a small rivalry already going. So even just sort of a one sentence thing at the start saying, oh, I see you just came from Bob's Shack. Well, how's the old guy doing? And since they're in the same area, they're going to know each other and be aware, at least, of what their competition is doing. So it could be a friendly rivalry. It could be a very antagonistic one.
Right.
And just having a few notes down, if you create that, can really help.
Correct. I agree. The more that you can create the world around them to be, I don't want to say more realistic, but more living, where they feel like the town around them actually has people in it rather than just a bunch of stat blocks dumped from a book to populate it, the more they're going to be willing to look for things in that town and interact with it to be more in depth in what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost adding a lot more depth to it. Like, you can always see the face of everything there, but you're wanting to give it a little bit deeper play to it, even if it's just a very hazy thing. So you can have an interplay that the players can deal with and be able to come up with their own plots with. If you have a smuggler or a small smuggling operation that is working for a Hutt or Black Sun and was given a YT-1300 to work off their debt or something along that lines, there could be a lieutenant who's trying to set up things to go off on their own, or a rival that is looking at these guys as the weak point in their crime lord's operation. The players are wanting to make things better for themselves, so why not throw in with this other guy and try and come up with things there?
Yeah, I'd agree. For me, an Edge of the Empire campaign has a lot of interpersonal connections with various NPCs, because if you think about, you know, Han Solo dealing with Jabba and being chased by bounty hunters, he had a relationship with all of these people. You know, he knew who Boba Fett was, who Greedo was, why Greedo personally hunted him down.
Of the five different reasons, yeah.
And, you know, with Jabba himself, and if you even look at shows like Firefly, one of the key things they have is building those interpersonal connections with various NPCs.
Yeah, and when you're looking at TV shows or movies, you have what generally is called world building, and that's when you start to make the world real, it's a lot easier for the players to become real, for the characters to become real and start acting as if they're inhabiting portions in the world that you've built. If you just have a lot of cardboard cutouts, essentially faceless NPCs, it's very easy for the players to just ignore them. If you've got a couple guys with names, then they've at least got something to go with. And if you give them mannerisms, especially using the little table in the back of Age of Rebellion to give quick little notes, it becomes a lot deeper of a world for them to inhabit and gives things that aren't just tropes that they can almost ignore.
Right. A lot of times if you dive too deeply onto the tropes, it becomes something that they've seen 100 times before and thus isn't rememberable.
No, exactly. The best trick to it, though, is don't fill up an NPC's mouth with a bunch of exposition. Just have little bits and pieces of the exposition show up in the opening of two or three different NPCs that they're dealing with, that the first person says a tiny bit, and then the second person is saying a little bit more on the same lines, and slowly growing it from that, making it be an entire theme of their interactions for the first bit of the session. So it isn't just this entire info dump on them.
Right.
It allows the players to start forming their own connections, and the thing that I've always been really happy with as a GM is when the players start trying to finish my thoughts, I'll be trying to find the right word, and then the players will start offering up a few of their own that sound better than the ones that are running through my head. Then they can start building on the world themselves. Once they've sort of bought in at that point, I kind of have them hooked, and they can start growing things as well as me, which is a fairly handy thing. When you get player buy-in to that point, you've got a long-running campaign.
Not just that, you know that A, the players are paying attention, and they're invested in what's going on, because they're thinking along the same tracks of the NPC that you're trying to have speak. They already know, to a degree, how that NPC is supposed to be talking.
Exactly. And that's what you're wanting. You're wanting the players to start caring about that. You do get the engagement, and you get the phones being put down. When the players are sort of hanging on your words, it starts becoming a lot less about worrying about what the players are doing as you're doing a bit of exposition, and they're trying to come up with the exposition with you. And you can guide it as opposed to just laying it in front of them, which distributes the creative load so much better than just having the GM being the one doling out things. So with the business aspect of things, it's a lot like the homestead. It has a lot of the same sort of feel as a homestead. But with the business, you also have, they're attempting to make money going through it, but also they've got a particular shtick to it. Like they can be hired for doing particular jobs, whether it's to be going into a place and repairing it, whether they're going to be providing personal protection, if they're a more military-based, or any one of those sorts of ideas to it. And it allows, in some ways, it's kind of like how crime bosses or the like would be hiring up a ship, but they're based out of a particular location. So you can have the guy who's running the diner down the street or something along that line still be a recurring character.
Sure. One of the interesting things about running a business is a difference in dynamics. Usually, in a lot of Edge of the Empire games, you have the characters at the start of every adventure looking for the next job, trying to figure out how they're going to keep their ship flying, where is the next thing to go, what do they do. On a business, on the other hand, you have things coming to them and them deciding on if they want to take it.
Yeah, the dynamic for that makes it a lot better for it. It allows the GM to start putting adventures in front of them and seeing where they go with it. But also it allows the players to feel like they've got a bit better control over the entire operation and get a bit of buy-in from that. And it also allows you to throw them curveballs. Now, they could be running a mechanical-style ship-fixing facility and then have someone shot coming in the front door and needing help. Or things along that lines, where you've given them things relatively along their stated preferences for the first few times, but now you're wanting to throw them a bit of a curveball, either starting off in a different fashion, or say you've been doing it for the same way the last couple times, starting off the same once again, but then it quickly going absolutely sideways from where they figure it's going to.
Sure, and as you said, some of them can be just things that are out of their normal depth, as, you know, someone shot walking through the front door when all they are is a bunch of mechanics and don't really know how to heal people. But on the other hand, with the giving them the option to turn down or take certain jobs, you can also sometimes throw in the offer which you cannot refuse.
That then becomes a really interesting fashion to see how the players will jump. When it's a business or pretty much anything, it's the players not really having the option to back down and say no. It really forces their creativity to come to the front. And with the stakes being that high, it encourages the players to start thinking a lot more about what can go wrong and what they can do to make it go right.
Right, especially if you have them being caught in the middle of a conflict between other parties. They're being forced to do this job. They don't necessarily want to, but in doing so, they're somehow endangering themselves.
That's a pretty nice idea.
Like going off your mechanic shop thing, it's you have some sort of crime boss coming, basically walking to the shop and telling them that he needs a modification done to his ship. In the process, they discover that the ship is smuggling spice or some other illegal goods. And then they get the inkling that there's an ISB agent or something like that also sneaking around. And the question is, do they try and help this adversary so that they can get out from under the thumb of the crime lord? Or do they have to help the crime lord cover up whatever's going on? Because otherwise they'll be implicated as accomplices. If they're being forced to add some sort of identity jammer or smuggling cargo holds the ship and they're found out, well then they're going to be tied to a smuggling ring or worse.
Yeah, having to choose between which of the bad sides that they're wanting to go with or having the two sides come down on them because things just go horribly, horribly wrong lends itself to some pretty interesting and hair-raising adventures for them, especially if they're trying to get out with almost everything intact. Now, that kind of brings us over to the base of operations. It's kind of like the homestead or the business, that it's a single recurring place that the players are going back to.
Right. The one disappointment I have with the base of operations in the core book is that it doesn't have a lot of details on how the players could expand or invest more into the space. It's left to be very vague.
Well, it is left to be fairly vague, but if you take into account the stuff that's shown up in the homestead, and then also taking a look at how they operate in the downloadable adventure from the FFG website for the beginner game, you can get a couple ideas of how you can help the players grow their base, even if it is just a single contribution level.
Correct, and that'd be one of the recommendations I'd have, is if people are running a base, is to look at the homestead rules, even the basics of the homestead rules that give the party a set of skills for using it as career skills, can be also very useful for a base, as most likely their base is going to specialize in certain types of things.
That's a really cool idea, and it allows the players to have a common theme to them. It helps bring the players together as a group.
Especially if you're running a type of campaign, such as, you know, a starfighter group or a group of commandos, and they are picking very diverse skills, there's probably a set of one or two skills that would be helpful for all of them to have as options as career skills, so that they don't feel like they're being shoehorned into certain specializations and careers.
Yeah, that would be a very handy way of doing it. And again, with the base of operations, you do run into the rebellion-supplied NPCs that allow you to grow. You can either grow trust and slowly build up into either having a traitor in your midst adventure, such as what goes on in Onslaught at Arda, or you can have things happen to different NPCs and the players having to go off and deal with this. If someone gets captured or someone's found out and their family then becomes in trouble. Things along that line.
There's also always the good third option of being given the most bare minimum of supplies in a base and them having to recruit the specialists which they're going to need to make this base fully operational, whether it's a mechanic who can fix everything in the base while they're off doing missions, or some sort of combat type person who can be training new recruits as, you know, the rebellion sends them more supplies and people.
Yeah, exactly. Having to go out into the local populace and either finding those who have low sentiment or low ideas of the Empire already and are looking to join up one way or another, or causing some of that to happen. Having a base of operations like that allows for the players to be able to go out and be a bit more over the top, because they've got some place relatively safe to retreat back to, which then kind of makes it more interesting and a little bit more corny, which actually can lead to more fun role-playing.
Yeah, one of the things that I would be doing if my players had a base of operations is throwing in the all-important threat of discovery. And it would be very just simple mechanic of tracking how notorious they are being in the area to see if people start poking around where their base is trying to find them. Basically, same thing for Empire Strikes Back. Is there an area that the Imperials know that these rebels are operating out of and start sending scouts or things of this nature to try and find them? And some of this can easily be, well, you know, they're well-known criminals, and they constantly walk around the local town without going in disguise or trying to hide who they are. Or if they've tried to incite lots of rebellion in the local population instead of spreading out their activities to hide where they are. Or they stole a major Imperial ship or any Imperial property, and instead of taking a way back that would disguise where they're going, just beelined it back base.
Exactly. And considering the age that Star Wars is in, the very ubiquitous recording. So if you're doing something and not being in disguise, the Empire is probably going to have pictures of you. And if you're doing it on a more civilized facility or planet, you've got a small data center that's collecting all this information and trying to go through it. So you could have the players being slightly sloppy with what they're doing for precautions about getting found out, and then even if they aren't really caught, they can still have this start showing up. Like, a ISB agent can be dispatched because shipments are continuously being stolen, or something along that lines, and having them then discover these people that are doing a somewhat nefarious plot.
Right. And I think that's one of the key things is that you see in both A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back is that the Rebellion has a constant fear of being discovered. And you see, especially in Empire Strikes Back, they're always preparing and planning to evacuate at a moment's notice. So even if they find the most perfect base, in the back of the PC minds, there has to be that if a Star Destroyer appears above this base, how are we going to get out of here with as much people and supplies as we can?
There's that. And then that's the perfect time for the very unused rule set within there of the fear checks. Because all of a sudden you've got a Star Destroyer overhead. The players are already sort of groaning and thinking, how am I going to deal with it? Now have the characters actually roll a fear check based on this. Sort of any of the first times that they're seeing something, creating a new thing that they have to deal with. It'll sort of allows, since you have to keep on playing on their fear of discovery, you can make a fairly rarely used part of the rules a more regular part of the rules.
It doesn't just have to be them that is necessarily making fear checks, especially if it's a well-staffed base, it's other NPCs that could, you know, a general fear of discovery starts gripping the base, and the PCs have to figure out how to deal with it, whether that's, you know, making leadership checks to find ways to inspire their troops, or trying to figure out what the greatest threat to discovery to their base is and eliminate.
Exactly, and trying to come up with what's actually going on and how to deal with it. It really forces the players to start considering a few more options than just, there's a thing, let's go blow it up. Because that sort of seems to be the first instinct of at least a lot of the mechanics. Possibly a few snipers.
There's a thing, let's blow it up, will work for the first few times. But after a while, let's see a thing and blow it up is going to draw a lot of attention.
Anything blowing up causes a lot of attention to happen. It doesn't just bring out the investigators, it also makes everyone else start questioning things. So this blew up. Well, now the populace is going to start being a lot more fearful of just everything. Because when's the next thing going to blow up?
How can propaganda from that also influence how the Rebellion's able to recruit and do stuff? If, you know, you keep on blowing up a spaceport or government buildings, at what point does the local population also start viewing the Rebellion as terrorists instead of actual rebels trying to free them from the Imperials?
At what point do they switch from freedom fighters to being terrorists in the eyes of the public? And would blowing something up ever be useful that isn't in a military mindset?
Yeah, there's a lot of either basic indications or simple mechanics, I think, that could be added to a game that would let, that would be interesting to have players be able to track what's going on and how they're being viewed.
Fairly simple way of doing that is sort of a HoloNews recounting at the beginning of every session of what happened last session. If there was sort of the end of an adventure, a recapping of that as shown through the lens of the HoloNet news, since that's the Empire's favorite way of getting information out.
It's something I've done in campaigns before, and I think it is incredibly effective, especially if it's between sessions. You know, if you have a weekly game going on, in the time between the game, you know, shoot out an email that's just a quick paragraph of the snippet of HoloNews that pertains to what they did last time.
And with that, it then creates that sort of deeper universe that we're talking about and have been for most of the show now, that it gives the players an extra thing to start thinking about, especially on how they're being perceived. So we've sort of shifted from a base of operations to sort of a strike team or a group trying to grow its own little part of the rebellion. And with that, that sort of comes up to the style of play of the Lambda class shuttle, where they have a Imperial shuttle that's been stolen that has good codes, and they're using that to get from place to place to place, at least as long as the shuttle itself is being undetected.
The idea of having Imperial codes can lead to a lot of really cool infiltration style missions where the party's able to sneak into an Imperial base to do something. It could also be kind of a bonus reward at the end of session zero. I mean, one of the things I love doing is throwing my players into a very chaotic moment at the start of the first session so that they are jumping straight into the action instead of planning. So one of the ideas would be that you guys just attacked a base, and now you're trying to escape. The entire first session is trying to make your way out of an alerted Imperial base alive, with the reward being stealing the Imperial Lambda shuttle off a pad and making away with it.
Exactly, and at that point, the players are both attached to the ship, but also they're kind of worried that an entire base just knew that we stole this. Though there is always the aspect of, since you're starting in the middle of the action, one of the very first things that the party could have done when they showed up was attach a lot of explosives to the power core, and then the base is no longer there as they fly away.
Correct. The base is blowing up behind them.
Exactly. Gets such a wonderful image. And having an image that the session ends on is sometimes priceless, especially if it just sort of comes up, such as the Lambda shuttle flying away while the base is blowing up around them. Imperials are just scattering as they go about.
Right. No, they can then use that Lambda shuttle to disguise themselves as Imperials. You can have a very different feeling of the campaign with that, where you're not necessarily fighting on the front lines to free a planet from the grip of the Empire, but instead you're discovering things about the Empire and trying to relay them back to Alliance Command so that they can act on.
And then also being able to run interference for other groups that, through some weird way, they're able to get in contact with you, and you act almost as sort of a troubleshooting squad, that you're able to go in and deal with things that, because you have Imperial codes and a proper Imperial ship, you can get in places where a normal rebellion cell just could never get into.
Right. Or breaking out a rebel cell who's gotten into too much trouble.
No, exactly. It leads to some very cool and very sneaky styles of gameplay and adventures. And having that sort of be the first adventure for it is a fairly fun way, and very, very Star Warsy style of introducing people to, this is your characters, this is your piece of equipment, go. It's something that you can really sort of grasp onto.
I think it would be a very fun style of game to run that would be different than how a lot of people approach it, a Age of Rebellion game.
Exactly. And just sort of that style of gameplay really works well for the Force and Destiny style play. That even having like a Jedi Mentor or a ship or a holocron, the players themselves being Force users, they're probably on the run from the Empire because the Empire's very interested in them. It seems like anyone who has an inkling with the Force is brought in for questioning or turning.
I would agree that to some degree. I would say anyone who seems to have strong potential in the Force is either recruited or eliminated, and groups that have ties to either the Sith or the Jedi are carefully monitored. I think there's a lot of options with other Force traditions, though, that the Empire more or less left alone.
That's sort of coming down to what the players are wanting to be doing in Session Zero, and also what the GM's wanting to set them up to be doing. If they are this other Force tradition, what sort of adventures does the GM have planned?
Right.
Because no GM has no plans. There's always, I'm getting this group together because I've got an adventure I'm wanting to run. So the GM has a few plans, and they can start moving them forward. Though, taking a look at how does a group find or come into having a Jedi mentor?
Right, and I mean, there's lots of ways of introducing, because this is not just going to be an NPC, this is going to be an almost a campaign-driving NPC, at least at the start.
This is most likely the first major NPC that the players are going to have driving them forward, and possibly for the entire first campaign. The Jedi Mentor becomes sort of this inciting action for them.
Right, and there's a lot of different personalities and ways that you can introduce them to Mentor. I mean, they could have grown up with a Mentor their entire lives. That's how they have the abilities that they have now. They could be finding this Mentor, in the midst of doing something else, that they all have Force potential, and the Force somehow brought them all together, but they do not see themselves as Jedi during this first session, and everything after that is them discovering what the Jedi actually are and how do they use these inklings of the Force that they start off with.
Exactly. Having little instances where the players can use the Force for little things, but then having the Jedi Mentor sort of become full effect and almost choosing the players, looking to expand their entire view of the galaxy and sort of opening their eyes to what's actually out there.
Well, it's very much a Obi-Wan-esque situation where you have a Luke who knows nothing of Force but has probably been using it subconsciously in his entire life. And now you have someone who can show up and explain to him why these things are happening.
Or taking a look at Kanan and Ezra from Rebels. That's almost the same sort of thing of you've got this young character who's barely got an idea of what's going on, but is able to do some fairly fantastical things, and then a much more experienced Force user taking them in and wanting to teach them. There's several different places, even just on the screen. It's also echoed in Episode 1, where Anakin's got amazing reflexes and is able to do pod racing unlike almost any other human. And from this, from his sensitivities, he's brought to the Jedi Temple, and eventually he becomes a Padawan, so that he can learn the ways of the Force, and then cause a downfall of everyone.
That's the thing, I think, that is an interesting way to start a Force and Destiny campaign that is not necessarily apparent in the careers and specializations that the book offers, is that having the players start off not knowing about the Force. They're not going to start off with training lightsabers and a suite of Force powers at their disposal. They are starting off as people who have now been told that they have a gift, and, they could be the start of rebuilding the Jedi Order.
With that, then having this just thrust upon them, where they have to go and find this person, that the players are going to have their own idea of what a Jedi is, and you as a GM can just absolutely mess around with that. You can try and incite a little bit of talk while they're on the spaceship going different places and just ask them, well, what do you think the Jedi Master is going to be? What do you think? And try and get a little bit of discussion going about that and find if there's any common themes that you're wanting to play up or you're wanting to sort of subvert and have them be this old drunk that is needing to be worked upon before they're even useful for teaching, sort of saving the mentor to help teach the kids.
Right.
Yeah. Now, with a Jedi mentor, there's so many different ways that you can start up a campaign that the mentors are the driving factor for the first one, and then once a party itself is established and has a decent dynamic on its own, the Jedi Mentor can slowly fade away.
Right, and I mean, as I'll just reiterate, that's one of the important things I feel about the Jedi Mentor is that they should not be treated as just a background piece. They shouldn't be treated as just another NPC. They should be treated at the start as a driving force in the campaign.
At least for that first campaign, I would pretty much elevate them to the level of a GM PC. That they may not be a main primary thing in the day-to-day adventuring of the party, but it's something that is near and dear to everyone there and should be treated as such.
Right.
The same way that the ships from Edge of the Empire or the Homestead is a GMPC in its own right.
Right, and if you do it correctly, it ties in with every player. I mean, that's the main thing is that if you were just going to start off with a mentor that everyone knows, I would have each player write a story, even if it's just a paragraph of two, of them and that mentor doing something.
Exactly. And that, like, having one adventure that the players went on individually with the mentor, or something that the mentor did for them, it then creates a connection to the players, and from the player to the mentor, and because everyone's got this one connection to a common person, you can then manipulate that to incite adventure and to bring the party together so that they are willing to go off and deal with whatever the GM's wanting to throw at them.
Right.
And it sort of neatly bypasses the question of, well, why are we all wanting to go on this? Which everyone just showing up in a cantina that never answers, or rarely answers. So do you have any ideas regarding the Holocron? Because they're fairly weird and wacky pieces of Star Wars technology.
The most basic idea that I've always had of Holocron is discovering some sort of ruins, and in the midst of those ruins, they discover Holocron. You know, for some reason, they've been drawn to an old base or the ruins of a temple or library, and in the midst of it, discover, you know, this little piece of knowledge.
And that would be a fairly decent way of doing it, especially having, like, for each of the players, having a little unique vision that they've all seen, that each player has their own little piece of the puzzle that they're trying to fit together, and you're giving them a little bit of the roadmap for what you're planning on doing for that first session. At the end of it, they acquire the Holocron, but they're all able to sort of steep themselves in dealing with the Force to acquire it. They can sort of be brought together because of it. The mysterious Force is bringing them together, and then from that, they are then having to work together to move themselves forward in the adventure and to acquire the Holocron, which then opens up and allows them to learn specific things.
Well, not just that, I think one of the key things to remember is that a Holocron itself isn't just necessarily a computer. In a lot of the books and comics, each of the Holocrons had some sort of personality attached to it based upon the person's memories who the Holocron is based upon.
It's almost a personality replication of whoever recorded the Holocron, which can turn into a fairly cool thing. It's almost a recorded or a droid version of a Jedi Mentor.
Because of that, the Holocron may even hide information for them because it does not think that they're ready for it.
Having a duplicitous GMPC becomes really awesome.
One of the other things is that it could try leading them to certain places to explore so that they can experience the history that the Holocron is trying to teach them.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea. Using the Holocron as sort of a combination of a map and a leader for the group, that it can lead the group itself on a continuing adventure throughout an entire campaign, as opposed to just starting off with an adventure and they then having the ability to learn things from it.
There's plenty of different ideas that you can try and show the group depending on how you want to approach it. One of them could be, why were the Jedi blinded. It's a holocron of a more recent master, perhaps even one who died while in exile and was able to construct a holocron. It's teaching them about dark times and the Clone Wars itself, which has kind of been lost to a lot of people. Even if it's only been 40 years, a lot of the propaganda has covered up what actually happened, especially through the eyes of Jedi.
If you've got a Jedi who did know this and was at the forefront of the Clone Wars itself, then seeing how things were going, decides to start recording their own holocron, having it lead them through the Jedi's own journey can be a really cool way of sort of bridging two different timelines. Being able to sort of insert a few older things that can work on sort of a small story aspect, and then having that echo with what's going on with the players and what the players are currently doing. Like little vignettes that the players are able to listen to and then serve almost like a diary, and then have the holocron lead them through the different things that it was talking about.
One of the things I like about the holocron is that it can act as a history lesson to show things that the group would have no other way necessarily of knowing about. You know, being able to see through the eyes of someone else, especially if you're having a situation where histories repeat itself.
That's a wonderful aspect to it. You can definitely get into that end of it. And with a couple of the holocrons that we've seen, they've had two or more people who have been doing the recording for it. So you could have different aspects of things going on as viewed by different people and showing the different points of view.
Even contradictory points of view, because people don't agree on why something happened.
Exactly. Which for an adventure, it makes it something really awesome.
Another interesting way that you can approach the holocron is that the holocron would be tailoring the information it gives based upon the person who is talking to it. So you can have the holocron interact with people in different ways based upon their interests. The person in the party who's more interested in history receives different information than the one who only wants to know about fighting techniques and how the Force combat stuff works. You can create very different sets of interactions with all those party members, even though it is a quote-unquote simple machine.
That's a reason why I, at least in my own head, have been likening it almost to a droid or something even more advanced than a droid brain, that you do have one or more personalities living in the holocron and reacting to the Force abilities of the people in front of them. Whether they're trying to teach someone who's a very combat-heavy person the ways of using their power in a responsible fashion, or it's something along the lines of the artisan and trying to teach them that they do have to take action, that it can't just be them sitting on the sidelines while other people are doing everything. And having that different point of view trying to be brought forward to the players, trying to have the holocron teach the characters and having the players sort of go through this with them. It's an awesome thing where you can teach against type or to type for the player characters.
Right. I mean, it can be a source of inspiration or chastisement based upon how the character is acting a certain way. If you have a warrior type player who continuously ignores the holocron, maybe at some point the holocron stops responding to them, because it's obvious that it is not abiding by any of the teachings.
Another way that it could be doing it is slowly either having the teachings essentially stop, but then the stories that it spouts start becoming of either very prideful Jedi or powerful Jedis that have ignored the advice of others.
Correct.
In some ways, you can then use the holocron to moderate the way that the party is acting, or at least having it act as the GM's voice, but in-game instead of out-of-game.
Yeah, and that's a good way to do it, particularly if a player is going dark side in such a campaign, and no one in the party is calling them out on their actions. You know, when a PC cuts down someone in cold blood, especially from a Jedi party, that should elicit some sort of reaction on from the good members of the party. It would be very hard for Jedi to accept such a crime done right in front of them. But all players may not be comfortable with doing that, but you could use the discussions or the interactions with Holocron to play up how that works. You know, Holocron asks them why they seem troubled.
And you can use a Holocron in many different fashions, but usually in a fashion of the players are at a particular rest point in their adventure, and they pull out the Holocron because they're wanting to be taught by it, or one person is wanting to take a look at it. And it then questions them about the things that have just gone on. And then you're able to sort of incite a discussion about it.
Right.
Which then uses character downtime in a way that elicits role-playing, which makes the characters a lot deeper. And the players can find out a bit more about the characters because they're being asked and almost examined about things that they've done with it.
Which could be even close to an after session type thing as you are, you know, rolling your morality and just in your score, have sort of that closing part of the session be the conversation with the Holocron as, you know, a member or all the party members, you know, explain what's been going on.
Now, that's a pretty cool way of doing it. Or flipping it on its head of having the Holocron being the role-playing warm-up for the day. And they're discussing what went on last session with the Holocron at the start of the current session. And then once they put that away, they can then deal with what's in front of them. Because now they're brought back up to speed. They've got an idea of what's going on. And then they can sort of be released on the game anew.
That's another good way of doing it, because it's going to make them think about what happened last time and what mental state they would have been at the end of the session, depending on where you ended.
Which then brings them a lot closer to how they were thinking, which then makes a more consistent character for them. So that it's always being brought up what's gone on before. It allows them to just fall into the character in some ways.
So, of all these different starting options, which one is your favorite for each type campaign?
Well, for Force and Destiny, I'm still trying to get my head around both of them, or all three of them, but the Holocron and Jedi Mentor is two that are really jumping out at me, because as we've been discussing for this last little bit, those are the ones that seem to be a bit more juicy. That they have a ship is, you've got a ship with any of the other two systems, which, don't get me wrong, has some really cool aspects to it. It's just the Holocron and Jedi Mentor being different allow for a very different playstyle to be elicited from it.
Yeah, I could completely agree with that.
With Edge of the Empire, that one really depends on what the party is wanting to do. Edge of the Empire just has so many different styles of things with it that until you've got a bit of an idea on what the player party is, it's really hard to come up with a sort of starting adventure to it, unless you're starting with the adventure and getting the players and the party to form around it. It's sort of a chicken and egg thing, and I'm really wanting to see what the players are going to bring me for characters before I start coming up with adventures for it.
You are correct. One of the things about Edge of the Empire is the multitude of ways which different games can happen, because depending on what direction the party goes, they can be very different games, and the needs of them can be very different.
And with that, it just sort of lends itself to getting what the party is or what the players are wanting to do. And then with that, you can create an adventure around that. That's kind of where I'm at with the Edge of the Empire stuff, is that there's just too many options to really decide at the beginning of what I'm wanting to do. Every now and then I come up with an idea of it would be cool to run sort of a bounty hunter adventure. And then if everyone has a huge amount of fun, then expanding that out. But the way I try and design campaigns is based around what the party's creating. Like, the players create a party, and then I try and get a campaign to work with what the players have given me, and trying to find a few stories that the characters suggest. And with Age of Rebellion, I just kind of want to do a Starfighter campaign, because, well, I mean, heck, just recently X-Wing and TIE Fighter got released on good old games, and it just kind of rekindles my desire to be doing Starfighter-y things.
So why you appreciate the Rebel aspect, I much more for the Imperial one.
Yeah, I'm kind of wanting to run a Starfighter campaign, though also the Lepskin style sort of sneaking around style of campaign is something that's been bubbling in my mind, and I've started off with a decent idea, and in recent weeks it's sort of crystallized into a few ways that I can make it even better than what it is currently. So I'm looking forward to being able to put that to my players.
Yeah, I really like the Rebel sneaking around idea. The one thing I would do to my party, though, is make it so they're all human.
That then does lend itself to being able to sneak into Imperial facilities a little easier, but there's so many other options for species that you can be.
Well, I agree. I feel like even having a single Wookiee in the party makes it very hard to run certain types of campaigns, as they are very hard to conceal.
Especially when they have a vibro-axe that likes to go through stormtroopers. But yes, they are very hard to conceal.
Well, I'm even thinking about episode 4. It's, you know, you had an entire group of people who could, for the most part, sneak around the Death Star, except for the Wookiee. And while that can lead to some very interesting situations, I think over the course of a campaign, it could get very tiresome for the group to deal with those situations every single time.
Even taking a look at episode 4, there was only one point where they were really having to deal with Chewie being a Wookiee. I mean, getting off of the Falcon and getting into the control room, they'd never had to do anything with him other than have him along. It was only when they were trying to get into the prison block did something have to go creative.
Sure, but even walking around the base, etc.
Guess it sort of depends on your point of view on what you can get away with a Wookiee.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't like the mouse room droid went off and reported that there was a Wookiee kicking around.
That you know of.
But they did still get away. So, for the starting accruments for a party, is there any for each of the systems that really speak to you for things that you're wanting to run?
For Force and Destiny, I would definitely run a campaign with the Holocron as the starting asset, mostly because I like diving into the history of things, and it would definitely be more about exploring the history of the Force, and if they are going to build the Jedi Order again, or something of similar idea, not necessarily only knowing the past lifespan of the Jedi, but the Jedi as a whole. What did they mean over time? How did their traditions change? What bad choices did they make to let them be destroyed?
No, that's a really cool idea. Now, I like that. I also like having a Jedi mentor for almost the same sort of reason, but the Holocron can go for really deep ways. And I think it's something that I'm probably going to be adding into the adventures that we're messing around with for Mad Adventure Society, at least as a side quest.
Other than that, I really like the idea of having bases in both Edge of the Empire and Age of Rebellion, because I feel that when you tie down a group to a particular locale, they get more immersed in what is happening in that locale because they can't just run away from it.
No, I definitely agree with you on that. When the players do have ships that they can just run away from everything, it starts becoming a very hard thing for the GM to create something that's interesting enough for the players to stick around with, so that the GM can reuse some of the same NPCs and start growing the universe that they're in.
Right, and the best part of storytelling is growing the universe with the players as part of it, so that they can see how their actions are affecting the things around them, but also how they got to the situation that they're in now.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Tales from the Hydian Way. You can find me on Twitter as DeuteriumIce.
And you can find me as XFile101361.
You can get all the Mad Adventure Society updates at Mad Adventure.
Our podcast is on iTunes, where you can find more episodes and rate us.
You can also find our sister podcasts on iTunes, such as Pottlebat, a general gaming podcast, Yell, our live play podcast, and Skill Monkey, who teaches you to explore new ways to use skills.
You can find many interesting gaming articles at madadventures.com. This has been reminding you that interesting NPCs are found, not made.
Character creation should always be an adventure within itself.